There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The information depicted in this podcast is purely for informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional before making any changes to your lifestyle or routine.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Boost Your Biology podcast. My name is Lucas, and I am the founder of Ergogenic Health. Together in this podcast series, we will go underground to explore cutting-edge health and human performance insights that you simply cannot search on Google to help you upgrade your existence. So, without any further ado, let's jump into today's episode.
Today, I'm joined in by a very special guest, somebody that I've looked up to over the years in regards to learning more about, you know, metabolic health and insulin resistance, because this man, in my opinion, is definitely a pioneer in this field. So, Benjamin, welcome to the show, man.
Lucas, hey, that's a nice introduction. Thanks, brother. Yeah, if I'm a pioneer of insulin resistance, it's simply because it's such an unpopular topic, so no one else cares to talk about it.
Yeah. So I thought we'd sort of maybe start out by, giving my listeners a bit of an introduction into your background and your experience in this field.
Yeah. So my background started with a focus on how the body responds to exercise. So I was initially interested in what happened at, say, well, most specifically the muscle. When we challenge a muscle, it gets bigger, it gets stronger. And that's what I started. That was the area of research I started with my master's degree. And then as I progressed through my graduate degree, I was increasingly interested in fat cells. And it really started with one moment where I found a manuscript where the scientists were publishing that fat cells secreted hormones, and in particular, pro-inflammatory hormones. So that was sort of a twofold interest. One, it identified that fat cells are an endocrine organ. So our fat tissue is an endocrine organ, like our thyroid or our pancreas. It's releasing hormones into the body. And two, it's these pro-inflammatory proteins that at the time we thought, and I think that's justified even to this day, it connects obesity to so many other diseases like insulin resistance. Part of the cause of insulin resistance is this process of fat cells getting too big and becoming inflammatory, and then it starts to spread this insulin resistance throughout the body.
So maybe we can touch on, I know there's a lot of people sort of discussing how body composition can influence, general metabolic health, but I know I've seen many people that are actually, they're actually skinny, but yeah, they can still be resistant at the same time. So do you want to sort of a little bit?
Yeah. So in fact, there are studies, I'm thinking of a couple studies in women that look at the effects, that look at the differences in women with and without polycystic ovarian syndrome, the most common form of infertility. What's relevant about that, lest someone be wondering, why is Bickman bringing up a fertility problem? PCOS at its core is a metabolic disease. In fact, an insulin resistance problem where the insulin resistance is affecting the ovary's ability to convert testosterone into estrogens, because that's what happens in the ovaries. Insulin blocks that from happening. And so the woman's never getting this big spike of estrogens, which then means she can never ovulate, which means she's has infertility as a consequence. So in these studies that look at women with and without PCOS that are the same weight, they're the same body weight, and yet the women with PCOS have more fat, and specifically more visceral fat. And so how we store fat matters more, I would argue, than how much fat we have. And that's a combination of both the specific location and like where we're storing fat, the depot, where it's physically located, and the nature of our fat tissue growing. Is it growing through individual fat cells getting big, what's called hypertrophy? That is a bad way to grow fat cells. That's when fat cells become insulin resistant. Or is it that the fat tissue is growing and it's growing through hyperplasia, where they're multiplying, they're proliferating? That's a healthier way to get fat.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard a lot of theories in regards to inadequate use of blood sugar being linked to excess free fatty acids in the bloodstream. So maybe, did you want to explore a little bit on that, how that's sort of linked to, yeah, like...
Yeah. Yeah, so one of the problems with progressive insulin resistance is that the body starts swimming in a sea of both glucose and fat. And that is happening, well, there could be a lot of variables that come into play, but I would argue the most relevant one is the fat cells becoming insulin resistant and leaking free fatty acids. That's one part. So normally insulin would come to the fat cells and tell the fat cells to stop, to store fat and to not leak it. When the big hypertrophic fat cell becomes insulin resistant, it starts leaking the fat, even though insulin's trying to tell it not to. So that's going to contribute to increasing free fatty acids in the blood. And then beyond that, indeed, quite distinct from that, is what happens when the liver becomes insulin resistant. When the liver becomes insulin resistant, it starts to break down its own glycogen, so it's stored glucose, and starts leaking that into the blood, increasing glucose. Even though insulin's trying to lower blood glucose, when the liver's insulin resistant, it doesn't get that signal to be storing glucose as glycogen. It starts to break down the glycogen. So the insulin-resistant liver is leaking glucose, and insulin is hyperstimulating the production of triglycerides that will get released as triglycerides within cholesterol, within lipoproteins like VLDL, which then gets, of course, converted to LDL throughout the body.
Yeah, I find that really fascinating. A lot of people have been discussing hepatic insulin resistance in the context of the carnivore diet.
In fact, earlier today, I see on my Twitter feed, a lot of people are bringing up this physiological insulin resistance that you see with the low carbohydrate diet. And I rage against that idea. I would just, the more, that is not true. I will say that with a very high degree of confidence. A low carbohydrate diet does not create insulin resistance. A carnivore diet does not create insulin resistance. It creates a form of glucose intolerance. And someone can choose to think that's a good or a bad thing. I don't care about that. I don't care which side of the argument they take in that regard. But what happens is, as the person is avoiding carbohydrates for an extended period of time, which, of course, you're doing completely on a carnivore diet, the body has so thoroughly shifted its fuel use to fat metabolism. It's so heavily relying on fat, which it does because insulin is so low now, that when you suddenly spike your glucose, then it takes a little longer to clear that glucose. You have a degree of glucose intolerance. However, that is not the same as insulin resistance. Insulin resistance in every single state, whether it is pathological, which we see spreading around the world, you know, the clinically relevant kind of disease state of insulin resistance, or whether it's the physiological insulin resistance that we actually do see with pregnancy and puberty. Those are the two instances. I say physiological because the body goes into insulin resistance on purpose, to serve a purpose, to help the kid grow through puberty, or to help mom get fat and help fetus grow quickly during pregnancy. In both of those instances, what they have in common is that insulin is elevated. You cannot have insulin resistance without hyperinsulinemia. I am unaware of a single instance of that happening ever, pathological or physiological. And that is important because it helps us understand that a carnivore diet or any low-carb diet does not cause insulin resistance, because the insulin comes down exquisitely low, very, very quickly, far better than any other intervention. And that indeed is at the heart of why I am an advocate of a low-carbohydrate diet, because the more I appreciate the relevance of insulin resistance in longevity and in disease, the more I appreciate that the key is keeping insulin low. If you can live a life with low insulin, you are going to have an insulin-sensitive body.
Mm. Yeah. One thing I wanted to sort of bridge upon was the fact that for some people, they experience normal fasting blood sugar levels, but their insulin is actually high. So as in, like, for example, a lot of doctors will run blood tests and, you know, they'll have a normal fasting fasting glucose, and then, but they're missing an entire picture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, that is one of the most important missions that I sort of have taken on. Mm. If there is one thing I hope someone, well, one contribution I hope I will have made by the end of my career will have been to play at least a small part in helping move insulin from the back row of all these conversations right up to the front. So the paradigm that you describe is so relevant, because you can have a patient coming in for their annual visits with the doctor, and the doctor is only ever doing the typical measurements. They're looking at lipids. The doctor's looking at glucose. And that's usually that's it. They look at the cholesterol lipid markers and they look at glucose, and that's the end of it. Done. And so they're looking at the person and they see, well, your glucose is normal. Ah, but your blood pressure is starting to climb. Your glucose is normal, but you have infertility. And so what ends up happening is the patient leaves with a prescription for a fertility drug or a prescription for their hypertension. And never, at no point, no conversation has it ever come up that maybe they should check insulin. And like you'd said, if they did, they'd find that in the midst of this normal glucose, there's this war being fought in the body where insulin is slaving away at ever higher levels in order to try to keep that glucose in check. But it does. As insulin resistant as the body's becoming, demanding more and more insulin, it's able to get the job done and keep the glucose in check. And then eventually, in some of these people, they reach the point where they are so resistant to their own insulin that even though they are still hyperinsulinemic, now the glucose starts to climb. And this state, high insulin, normal glucose, is insulin resistance, and it can happen 10 years before the glucose starts to change. So imagine, not only would we treat the disease better, we would detect it so much sooner and be able to intervene so much earlier if we just stopped looking at metabolic health through the lens of glucose and, in contrast, started embracing the idea that insulin matters, arguably more than glucose.
Yeah, I mean, I find that so fascinating, the fact that it's so neglected. But I'm really, I'm happy that you're voicing your research, and hopefully that's, you know, that's something you can put forward, because it's definitely something that's it bugs me as well. You know, when I see people saying that they feel like metabolically healthy, I'm just like, I'll question them. I'm like, all right, have you had your fasting insulin check? It's like, no.
But yeah. And in fact, indeed, Lucas, it goes even further. Like I just alluded to with treatment, if we only look at disease like type 2 diabetes through the lens of glucose, then once the glucose does start to change, conventional medicine would say, well, who cares what your insulin is? Let's push it up even higher. And so they'll start giving the person like drugs that are called insulin secretagogues, like forcing the beta cells to make more insulin, or just frankly giving them insulin injections. They actually start treating themselves with exogenous insulin, putting more insulin into the body. So it was already a high insulin, becomes super physiological, you know, it hits the roof. And sure enough, the glucose comes down. And so the clinician will say, oh, well, we're doing it. It's working. We're lowering your glucose. But when you treat a type 2 diabetic with insulin or with an insulin secretagogue, there are studies to show that you increase the risk of cancer significantly and you increase the risk of heart disease significantly. So while we are giving them wonderful glucose levels, we are making them fatter and sicker than before.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to maybe touch on, I know there's people that experience the sort of reactive hypoglycemia. How does that come into play?
Yeah. That's a great question. Yeah. Typically reactive hypoglycemia or postprandial hypoglycemia is when that's an early sign of insulin resistance, where the person has eaten a glucose and insulin spiking carbohydrate. You know, that's like we go eat a bagel. And then in the healthy person, glucose comes up, and then there's a commensurate appropriate insulin response, and it brings the glucose right back to normal, and the insulin comes back to normal. In insulin resistance, we've spiked up the glucose, and because maintaining a high glucose level is lethal, and I do mean lethal, then we get an insulin response because insulin wants to save the body, of course. But in the insulin resistant state, it's too high. It's not commensurate with the glucose. And so this insulin overshoot results in this temporary hypoglycemia. So the glucose curve went up really high. Now it has come down and here was normal and it has dipped below normal. This period of time where someone has this relative hypoglycemia, and I do emphasize relative because it's not going to be like clinical hypoglycemia, which is typically considered around, I don't know, millimolar, and you're in Australia. So anyway, it would be just a level that most people can't get to. Like right. True hypoglycemia is a level most people can't get to. But that doesn't change the reality of the fact that if someone is used to a certain level of glucose, when they have pushed it down, even for a short period of time, that is, they feel it, especially if a person is used to always relying on glucose as their primary fuel and not fat, they're sensitive to that relative dip. And the person can sense a very anxious hunger about 2 hours after eating or so. And they feel like they need to eat something again, which is laughable because the person is probably often they are overweight. They've often eaten hundreds or thousands of calories right 2 hours before. There's no possible way that person actually needs energy. But because they are like stuck in sugar burning mode, which is the definition of metabolic inflexibility, because of the elevated insulin, they're always burning glucose. In the person with metabolic flexibility, that relative drop in glucose, they wouldn't even notice it because they're so able to just burn fat as well. They can just switch to an alternative fuel. You know, they are able to use the human metabolism like the hybrid that it is and shift between sugar burning and fat burning quite readily because insulin can come up and down. But when you're stuck in sugar burning mode because of chronic elevated insulin, you get that. You can potentially get that reactive hypoglycemic period of time, and the person will sense this as a genuine, almost panicked kind of hunger because the brain, which is so dependent on glucose in that person, senses this relative reduction in glucose and lights up the hunger system.
Yeah, I mean, that's super fascinating. I sort of want to segment into perhaps linking in HPA axis dysfunction or like cortisol hyperreactivity in regards to, you know, potentially damaging beta cells and things like that.
Yeah, so you're kind of invoking the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, so cortisol is extraordinarily powerful with regards to its effects on the body. So cortisol comes from the adrenal gland. Just as all listeners know why we're mentioning the adrenal gland at all. Cortisol is one of the main hormones that comes from the adrenal gland. And cortisol, one of its main actions or purposes, one of its main purposes is to increase blood glucose. and it will want to increase blood glucose through any means. Indeed, it will strip the proteins from our very muscles in order to get those amino acids to send to the liver to have the liver make new glucose. It has no regard. It will inhibit recovery and healing just so that the body doesn't use glucose in the process. Cortisol wants to break everything down just to increase blood glucose. Insulin is an opposite. Insulin wants to build things up and in so doing, pull in energy from the blood like glucose. So if you have a state of chronically elevated cortisol, which absolutely can happen these days, you will cause rampant insulin resistance. That stress hormone causes insulin resistance. And this happens, I say it's rampant, this happens in part because of the psychological, emotional stress that we constantly live with. You know, it's hard to get on social media nowadays, especially without being inundated with these hyper-polarized political stances. And most people are sleep deprived because they can't get off their phone. And so they're sleeping poorly or they're anxious when they're sleeping. And that is also a stress, sleep deprivation. So I'm getting off on a bit of a tangent, but when you're spiking cortisol, you are destroying the body, literally breaking the body down, and all for the sake of increasing your blood glucose levels.
Mm. Yeah, you obviously touched on sleep being a profoundly important factor in potentially like mediating, you know, the effects of insulin resistance. Do you want to sort of touch on how sleep deprivation can influence somebody's ability to tolerate sugar?
Yeah. Yeah, so sleep, like I mentioned, sleep deprivation is a stress, and it's a very powerful one. This has been done clinically where healthy college students were kept awake. You know, they were like basically aggravated and you know poked at all night to make sure they stayed awake, and they were significantly, demonstrably insulin resistant the next day. There is what I'll say about sleep. It's interesting where. Every time we wake up, there's this little bump in cortisol every morning. That makes the body a little more insulin resistant during a few hours in the very first part of the morning when we're waking up, or right around the time, you know, so typically around like 4 to 7 a.m., the body has this cortisol bump. It starts to make the body a little insulin resistant. And that has a physiological relevance. It's thought that happens in order to increase blood glucose, in order to feed the brain, as the brain is kind of coming awake again and its energetic needs increase compared to when it was sleeping, when it was resting, if you will. Now it needs more energy. And so it's nice that we can spike the glucose a little bit because of the cortisol spike. And now we can feed the brain adequately. Although, of course, the brain does not have a total dependence on glucose. It can also use ketones. So I just need to mention that. But chronic sleep deprivation essentially just drives that cortisol phenomenon into overdrive. And the longer cortisol is elevated, the longer it is antagonizing insulin. It is called an insulin antagonist. And insulin just has to work harder and harder in order to try to do its job.
Mm. Yeah, very interesting. Maybe we can sort of touch on a little bit about, you know, the link between stimulating mTOR versus AMPA, because I know they're two, you know, very popular topics.
Yeah,
following metabolic health. So, what's the link there?
Yeah, you're touching on some really relevant stuff. mTOR, just by way of introduction for those listening, mTOR is a protein in our cells that will tell a cell to build. So it's very anabolic. It wants to build things. It wants to pull in energy and store it and build. So it's a good thing. We need it. Absolutely. It's essential to human survival to have that turned on sometimes, but not all the time. What is interesting about mTOR is at the level of the muscle cell, which is one of the most obvious cells to pick with regards to something growing, if you are chronically activating mTOR, it starts to resist its effects. The mTOR signal starts to dampen. You don't get that anabolic response anymore. So what you need to do to really appropriately take advantage of mTOR and maintain lean mass, bone and muscle and beyond, you need to spike it. It has to be cyclical. You want mTOR to be turned on and then it's turned off. It's turned on, it's turned off. And exercise can turn that on. Dietary protein can turn that on. And insulin itself can turn on mTOR very well. Now, AMPK is the opposite. It's the yin and the yang. So mTOR wants to build something up. AMPK wants to break it down. So AMPK would be telling a cell to break down what it has. Don't build things up. So this is obvious if we look at like the liver and the fat cells. AMPK stimulates the breakdown of stored fat and the breakdown of stored glycogen in the liver. But if you look at the fat cell, when AMPK is turned on, the fat cell will start undergoing lipolysis, and it will stimulate the sharing of energy and the use of energy. So if you activate AMPK in a muscle cell, you're stimulating glucose oxidation and you're stimulating fatty acid oxidation. So these two hormones, the yin and this yin and yang within the cell, they are essential. They're each, you know, pulling the cell at different times, one way or the other. And it's a sort of beautiful ebb and flow as it's supposed to be. One of the problems nowadays with mTOR, if you'll allow me to kind of elaborate, is that people fear it too much, or they fear it mistakenly. It is true that if you are chronically activating mTOR, you are likely feeding, increasing the potential for cancer, for a tumor to grow. And so a lot of people will invoke a fear of mTOR because of a fear of cancer, and mTOR being one of the primary protein signals that helps a cancer grow. And also, they will invoke a fear of mTOR with regards to aging, because if you're chronically keeping mTOR activated, although we don't have evidence for this in humans, but it seems that you are promoting aging and that the key to longevity is to not be spiking mTOR too much. Now, because dietary protein increases mTOR, that has resulted in some people creating diets that they posit can promote longevity just because you're not spiking your mTOR as much by avoiding the protein. The problem with that perspective is that insulin also spikes or activates mTOR. And so these diets that are supposedly promoting longevity by inhibiting by not spiking mTOR, they are often very high carbohydrate diets. And that to me is just laughably wrong-headed. To eschew protein in favor of carbohydrate because you don't want to spike mTOR, when insulin can spike mTOR even stronger than amino acids do, that's just silly. And the human evidence does not support that paradigm. If you look at protein 65, those that eat the lowest amount of protein have the highest mortality. And let me say that in a different way. So the people that are over the age of 65, if they, those that are eating the higher protein have the best longevity. So that directly challenges this idea that that protein is some devil when it comes to aging. That data directly challenged that idea.
Mm. Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the protein side of things, because obviously, you know, there's a lot of people discussing the different types of amino. You know, we've got the insulinogenic amino acids and the ketogenic amino acids. Mm-hmm. So, but there's crossover as well. There's some that are both. So perhaps maybe we can discuss a little bit about, maybe is there any research in that realm of like restricting particular amino acids, potentially methionine?
Yeah. So if I remember correctly, and I do have to speculate a little bit, I think the most insulinogenic is alanine. And I think arginine is also quite insulinogenic, but a listener would be able to confirm after and prove me right or wrong. But regardless, I personally do not believe we should worry about that. We should eat amino acids as God intended them to be eaten, which is from animal proteins, and pay no regard to, well, am I getting the more insulin spiking amino acids or not? Who cares? If it's coming from an animal protein, it's one that we are built to eat. Dairy, meat, and eggs, those are proteins that we have eaten since time immemorial as humans, and they are the best. They are demonstrably the best. And I'll kind of riff on that for just a moment, just because I feel so strongly about it. Nowadays, there's this obsession with plant protein. And I can see why, because if you are making a protein supplement, you as a company, as a manufacturer, you want to use plant protein because it is so much cheaper than animal proteins. And I can say that from experience, as with a couple of my brothers, we've made a protein shake. In fact, I'm not so subtly displaying it here. And in fact, let me just be really self-promoting for a moment. Everyone who wants to learn about it, go to Get Health. And that's HLTH.com to learn more. But back on the topic, as a manufacturer, you want to use plant protein because it's so cheap and it lets you check the boxes of being, you know, vegan friendly. You know, and that lets you have a bigger market and people want to see that on labels for some reason. But these proteins are inferior in every way. You take the best plant proteins and they will still not have all the amino acids that you need. They will not be as good. Second, all plant proteins have, this sounds like it's mythical, but I swear it's real. Everyone can look it up. Plant proteins have things called anti-nutrients that actually physically block the body's ability to absorb and to digest all those amino acids. Things called tannins, lectins, trypsin inhibitors, phytic acids. These are real things that get enriched in plant proteins. The scientific evidence to support all of that. And then lastly, when you are concentrating protein from these very protein-poor things like peas, you know, I don't know the exact number you'd need, but let's say you'd need 1,000 peas to get one serving of protein. The protein is what you're wanting to get, but you get some unintended things as well, like all the metals. Plants are naturally pulling up metals from the earth. And that happens. There's no avoiding that. And when you just eat the plants, you get such a minuscule, negligible amount that it doesn't matter. But when you've been concentrating these plants, you get higher levels, dangerous potentially levels of lead and arsenic. Plant proteins are high in those heavy metals. So for heaven's sakes, people, do yourselves a favor. Get plant, get animal protein. And I would even say, get it the way God intended, which is with fat. Protein comes with fat, and even the science supports that balance, where a study was done. This is, of course, an academic setting where they were pulling biopsies from muscle and looking at the rate at which the muscle was making new protein. So that's something called muscle protein synthesis. And after a bout of exercise, when they gave these men a protein load, they noticed that muscle protein synthesis was significantly higher than without the protein. And then interestingly, when they gave them protein and fat together in a one-to-one mass, not by calorie, but by mass, then the muscle protein synthesis went up a significant level again. So fat and protein is more anabolic than protein alone. And I think that this is reflected in nature. The best protein sources, dairy, meat, and eggs all come with fat. So who are we to try to outsmart what nature has given us? Let protein come with fat. It's natural, it's more satisfying, and indeed it is more anabolic.
And when you say the fat, you're specifically referring to saturated fats, right?
I sure am. Yeah, Lucas. So let's get controversial. Yeah. So yeah. Saturated fat is absolutely been demonized with no justification. When I sort of pillars of nutrition, one of my pillars is don't fear fat. Embrace it. As a species, we absolutely need it. There are fats that are essential to human survival. So eat them. And you cannot get them from plants. You cannot get the right omega-3 fatty acids from plants. It's impossible. So more evidence that we are not meant to be vegan, with all due respect to vegans. So saturated fats are part of our natural evolutionary diet. When I'm advocating eating fat, I will say eat fat from animals and fruits, because that's how we've eaten them forever. The animal fat is obvious since we've been eating animals since the very beginning. There's no questioning that. And then the fruit fats we've also been eating for millennia, because fruit fats, the most common are going to be in human history. It would be olives and coconuts. Because all we needed to do was get the flesh of the fruit, and then just squish it. Once we compressed that flesh, we would get an oil from it. You cannot say that about all the other fats, like soybean oil, canola oil, corn seed oil. everything that they call vegetable oil, none of which are vegetables, they're all seeds, and they're all these industrial seed oils that have to go through a remarkable process in order to get oil from them. But I would say, we shouldn't confuse that with milled seed like chia and flax. And let me just defend those for just a moment, because I know in the low carb space, we typically will just poo-poo all seed fats and just say they're all garbage, avoid them all. In general, that's true. But the omega-3, the seed-based omega-3, alpha-linolenic acid that you get from like flax and chia, while it does not convert well into EPA and DHA, which are the essential fatty acids, it is still there. It is very ketogenic. In fact, ALA, that omega-3 from like milled flax and chia seed, is the most burned of all the long-chain fats. So the long-chain fatty acids are the predominant fats in our diet, and that's appropriate. But that one omega-3, ALA, is the most burned. It's burned more rapidly than any of the other long-chain fats. And actually, that makes it the most ketogenic of all the long-chain fats.
Super interesting. Well, yeah, obviously, we sort of segmented into a little bit on the polyunsaturated fatty acids.
Yeah, I did.
Debated quite a lot in terms of creating lipophosphine and also, damaging cell membranes and things like that when they become oxidized.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. So indeed, it's that reality that I have in mind when I advocate natural fats like fruit and animal fats. Let's look at this in the context of heart disease. I find like that's a helpful way to look at the utility or the lethality of the fats that we eat, the long chain fats. When we are worried about heart disease, what we're worried about is the formation of atherosclerotic plaques. We get concerned with the idea that our coronary arteries are going to get blocked with these plaques and will block blood flow, and then we'll have a heart attack or we'll have a stroke if it's blocking blood vessels in the brain. Needless to say, that's something we want to avoid. There is tremendous debate, tremendous indeed theorizing and speculation as to what is the actual origin of the plaque. So everyone listening should know, we don't exactly know what causes an atherosclerotic plaque to form. But what appears to be essential is the formation of lipid peroxides. When a lipid has become oxidized, it has become this very reactive molecule that we just need to do our best to avoid. Because once it's reactive, it can, like you said, it can start banging in to cell membranes, proteins, DNA, and damaging all of those things, wrecking a cell, causing a mutation, disrupting the mitochondria. So when a lipid becomes oxidized or becomes a lipid peroxide, then it's problematic. And so then we should say, well, which lipids become lipid peroxides, or which are the most reactive? Well, it's the polyunsaturated fats, because those polyunsaturated have multiple unsaturated sites, and they're the most susceptible to becoming reactive. Mm. In contrast, the fats that are the most stable are the saturated fats. So the very fats that we fear causing heart disease may in fact be the ones that are the safest when it comes to heart disease, because they don't react. Indeed, I know of no evidence indicating that in the body, a saturated fat can become a lipid peroxide. I don't know of that happening at all. Indeed, if you want to make a saturated fat reactive, you have to heat it up to like 300 Celsius, which you can do. But even still, if you're cooking with an oil, you're heating that oil, the more saturated the oil is, the more stable it will be. And so if you're making something on the stovetop with a pan, then you want to go for something like butter or even better, coconut oil, which is almost totally saturated fat, because it maintains its stability. It does not become these reactive lipids that are going to damage every cell once it comes into your body. And then, of course, if you're using something at room temperature, well, then the monounsaturated fats are perfect, like olive oil or avocado oil. Avocado is also a fruit fat, of course. In those instances, but again, it's mostly monounsaturated. It is still very stable. And because it's a liquid at room temperature, well, then it's perfect, because you can't put coconut oil on your salad. And so then a monounsaturated fat becomes perfect. But the hotter you're going to get it, the more saturated you want it to be. And that is evidence of just how stable saturated fats are.
I love it, man. Yeah, I love it. There's a lot to unpack there, and I guess my listeners will probably want to learn more about that. I'm sure you probably covered that in the book in the background.
Yeah. So thanks for mentioning. Everyone, go buy my book. Help out a poor professor. So in Why We Get Sick, I do elaborate a little bit on this, the differential effects of fatty acids, and I do it actually as a little kind of tangent. Throughout the book, I have lots of little tangents that don't really necessarily fit within the orderly structure of the book. And this was one of them, where I highlight the real conflict in data in trying to point the finger at saturated fat in the context of heart disease, because that's where it all started. The fear of saturated fat all entirely started because of a fear of heart disease. And it was this suspected culprit, and the data just don't support it.
Exactly. All right. So maybe we've got about maybe 10 more minutes until this live is over, but maybe we can touch on a little bit about perhaps time restricted.
Time. That's a great question. Before I answer that, let me just pay homage to Dr. Jason Fung. Anyone who wants to learn more about intermittent fasting really should look at the work of Jason Fung. We in this space, anytime we talk about intermittent fasting, I think it's appropriate to acknowledge that he really is the godfather of modern interest. I don't know of anyone who was talking about it before him, and certainly no one's been as much of an advocate. Anyway, that's enough. Congratulations to Jason. The power of intermittent fasting is you simply give the body a break from an insulin spike that comes from eating food, especially carbohydrates, of course. When you don't eat something, insulin just stays low. And let's put that in the context of a 24-hour period. One of the great tragedies is that when someone is waking up, at that latter part of sleep, insulin has finally, maybe, depending on the person, it has finally come down. And of course, you're insulin sensitive and it came down well early into the night. But if you're really insulin resistant, it's taken hours for your insulin to come down, and it finally did. It's finally down. Your body has finally shifted to fat burning, away from this constant sugar burning. And then how tragic is it that our first meal of the day is the most starchy, sugary meal of the day? It's a sugary bowl of cereal, two pieces of toast, a bagel, a glass of orange juice, you know, some other junk. And boom, they start the insulin roller coaster. And then either because they're hungry 2 hours later or because they've been told to eat six little meals a day, right when insulin starts to peak and want to come back down, they bump it back up, and then they bump it back up. And then every waking moment is spent in a state of elevated insulin, which of course drives insulin resistance very, very well. When you intermittent fast, you just break that cycle. And that's one of the powers of, say, fasting through breakfast, which I find that the easiest one. But let me touch on that again in a moment. But if you fast through breakfast, like you just have a cup of tea or something, I don't drink coffee, but if someone's drinking coffee, whatever, just don't add sugar or something into it. I consider that fine. It's not breaking a fast by my standards, because you're not eating any calories, really, and you're not taking in anything that's going to spike your insulin. So you wake up in the morning and you just coast right through breakfast. You keep insulin levels low, and then you bump up your insulin for lunch, and then you shift a little bit to sugar burning, but then give yourself a break again. Don't eat dinner for 4 or 5 hours, and then you get another bump, and then stop. Once you've eaten dinner, you stop. And I will tell you, I will confess, everyone, here's my confession. That evening time after dinner is when I'm at my most tempted. That is when all of a sudden, all my little cravings start to just, what was throughout the day just a small little whisper of craving, suddenly becomes this almost unavoidable shouting in my ear to start indulging. And yeah, one of the ways I get through that is I just make sure we just don't have junk food in the house. And for me, we don't have cereal, because cereal is my absolute weakness. I would eat cereal every moment of the day if I could. So I just make sure we don't have those kinds of foods in the house. We have other snacks for the kids, cheese sticks and things like that. So nevertheless, that's the power of intermittent fasting, to get that back on topic. My confession's over. You pick a meal at one end of the day, and breakfast just is the easiest, partly because it's not social. for me, I'm very much a family man. My family is everything. I am the breakfast maker in the family. That's just part of the dynamic of my family. I make breakfast family. So I get up, I've made breakfast. My kids don't care one bit if I don't eat breakfast with them. If I've made them some kind of healthy waffles, they don't even notice that dad doesn't eat. You know, I'm talking with them, they don't care. It doesn't change the family dynamic. But if I fast through dinner, then it's awkward. You know, we're sitting around the counter or the table in the kitchen, and they would notice. You know, everyone's plate is full except dad's. And so even though I actually think fasting through dinner is better, I'll confess, I think fasting through dinner is better. I know for me, the few times I have done that, my cravings in the evening are practically non-existent. It just doesn't work for me. As a family guy, fasting through dinner is just a little too awkward for my family dynamic. But again, I will say, if someone can do it without ruining their social life, including their family dynamic, then I actually believe fasting through dinner is better than fasting through breakfast.
And is the reason being because as we get closer towards bedtime, melatonin starting to rise, and we know that melatonin is antagonistic to insulin, or are there other elements to this?
Yeah, so I don't know whether melatonin is relevant to that. That is tempting to speculate. I know melatonin is relevant to metabolic health in some general ways. I think for me, by not spiking my insulin at dinner, even if it's kind of a low carb meal, it just helps me. Just the cravings just stay at bay. I can't really explain it that well. Just by not putting something in my guts, I can just coast through it more easily than I would otherwise.
Yeah. Okay. It makes sense. All right. Well, we've probably got about like 5 minutes before this IGTV pretty much finishes, but maybe we'll finish off by letting my listeners know where they can learn more about you and your books and even some of your talks as well.
Yeah. So my book is here. It's available for sale anywhere books are sold. And really, I appreciate any purchase. I really do. The book is essentially about insulin resistance, why it matters. In other words, like the statistics of just globally how relevant it is, because it is shockingly prevalent. And then I highlight all the diseases. I really dive in very specifically with sections and chapters, all the diseases that come from insulin resistance. And then I progress to where insulin resistance comes from, what are its origins, its causal factors. And then lastly, the happy ending is what to do about it, because it's very modifiable. And then my involvement on social media is really intended to be strictly scientific. I'm not posting pictures of my meals. I'm never posting pictures of my family. Rarely it'll be a picture of me. And I say that because I just did today. But it's very often just meant to share the latest science, or even if it's years old, with regards to human metabolism. And so with all that as a preamble, people can find me at Ben Bickman, PhD, through pretty much all the platforms.
Awesome. Well, that pretty much wraps up today's episode. Maybe I might just ask you one final question. Maybe
do it.
Three tips that you can suggest for people to improve insulin sensitivity.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I'll gladly answer that. So first tip, control carbohydrates. So just be smart. What I say, starch smart, just know what you're getting. And essentially, if it comes in a bag or a box with a barcode, it's starch to be careful with. Focus on fruits and vegetables and eat them, don't drink them. Second, prioritize protein. Make sure you're getting around 1.5 to even up to 2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. And if you're really overweight, then it's per kilogram of ideal body weight. And that just has to come from animal. Don't waste your calories and money on plant proteins. It is a true waste. So make sure you get enough protein. And then don't fear fat. As that fat is coming with that protein, or you feel like you want to add some fat onto the roasted vegetables or whatever else, do it. And then let it be from animal and fruit sources, and you'll be doing your body a favor. So those are my three tips. Control carbs, prioritize protein, don't fear fat.
That's brilliant. Well, thanks so much, Benjamin. It's been a pleasure having you on to the show. And yeah, I guess my listeners are going to really appreciate this, and there's a lot of useful content here. So again,
my pleasure. Lucas, thanks for reaching out. I enjoyed the time. Thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay. See you, brother.
Thank you, everyone, for joining in to today's episode. For in-depth show notes and lessons learned, visit nofilter.media/boostyourbiology.
This has been a No Filter Media production.
Say what you want.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.